Focus today is devoted to answering your questions about pet care. Does that dog bite? That's a familiar question, and the truth is, lots of dogs bite under certain conditions. This week is National Dog Bite Prevention Week, a time when the National Veterinary Medicine Association tries to spread the word about preventing dog bites and getting the proper first aid when dog bites happen. Our guest on Focus can give you some tips. She's Dr. Sally Foote, who specializes in small animal veterinary medicine and dog and cat behavior at her clinic in Tuscola. We'll also be talking about keeping your pet free of fleas and ticks as the weather starts to warm up. And Dr. Sally Foote is ready to answer any other pet questions you have. I'm Jim Meadows, and our topic on Focus today is pet care with Dr. Sally Foote. It's all coming up right after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and today we're devoting an hour to pet care advice with Dr. Sally Foote. She's a small animal veterinarian from Tuscola, specializes in dog and cat behavior, and you can phone in or email your pet care questions to Dr. Sally Foote, the phone number 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL if you want to call toll-free from out of town. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Dr. Sally Foote, welcome back to Focus.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here again.
And we wanted to talk about, well, it's National Dog Bite Prevention Week.
Yeah.
And the figures I have is that each year in the U.S., more than 4 million people are bitten by dogs. One in five of those people will require medical attention. So since this is National Dog Bite Prevention Week, wanted to open the show with some talk about preventing dog bites. And, you know, I remember being bitten by dogs two or three times as a kid. And I don't remember them being bad, vicious dogs, but they were dogs I was playing with. Where did I go wrong?
Thanks. I mean, that's really great you bring it up this way, because it just hits right on some of the statistics that surprise a lot of people. First of all, the most common group of people to be bitten are children under the age of 6, but certainly under 18, you know, when we look at statistics. And secondly, it's by a dog you know, because without realizing it, how, say, you approach the dog, where the dog might be, especially when dogs are near their food or near their bed or near their toys, they want to guard it. And when a dog gets up to the point of, say, growling, you know, or lifting its lip and snarling, that dog is really very, you know, very tense and very afraid, and is really throwing out every warning that I'm going to bite you. So sometimes we, you know, the human, we only recognize that as a sign of saying, oh, he might bite. And literally it can go within like half a second when they go from, I'm kind of afraid, in the, you know, person continues to approach to, they snarl real quick and then go to bite because, you know, the child is still moving closer. So I guess that's where you kind of went wrong, but you probably didn't know. And that's the point of me being here today, is to help people know.
And those were cases, those were dogs I was playing with that I had played with before.
Mm-hmm.
But yet something happened.
Right. What the term is called triggers. In other words, there's something going on. And it can be a variety of things that in this instance may be triggering or setting this dog up to want to perhaps guard their body, or they're more tense or afraid in this situation, in this time. So, for example, let's say you were playing with your own dog, and the day before your dog got its vaccinations. And so, you know, it's common to have a little bit of, say, muscle pain, you know, not feel the best after vaccination like a person. And so because their body isn't feeling so good, now today when you stroke over their back, you know, where they got their shots, it hurts. And that pain has a dog like, oh, I don't want you to touch me. And what he's trying to do maybe is to step away from you. But you know, don't understand this dog like turning its head and stepping away from you as a way of saying, please don't touch my back. And you're like, oh, I love you. So you go back to keep petting the back. And now the dog may flip his head real quick, like snapping at you. But you don't realize, you know, that's the warning, I'm going to bite you. and you're still thinking, oh, but I love you, you know, Fluffy. And you go and you pet him that third time. And to the dog, he said, I've warned you once, I've warned you twice. Well, now I've got to bite you to tell you to really stop petting me because my back hurts. And that may have been, say, the setting. The trigger was the pain. That was a pain trigger. Other times it can be, maybe this is the day that it's Memorial Day weekend and we have all family over. There's a lot of people. And this dog doesn't like, you know, lots of crowds and lots of people. So the dog is more tense, you know, and that all their added people was a trigger to have him be more nervous and more afraid, such that then when you did your normal greeting, which when you're alone wasn't a problem, but adding in these other people was a trigger, it had him heightened up to the fear and to possibly aggress.
So since you may not know when these situations are going to occur, what are the good rules of thumb in approaching even a dog you're familiar with?
Okay, good rules of thumb are this. Some of the old sayings are still very true. Let a sleeping dog lie. Do not disturb a dog when they're sleeping. I can't tell you the number of calls I've had from people, especially with kids. Their dog is sleeping on the couch, you know, and even cats too, laying there, sleeping on the couch, sleeping in its own bed. And then they go up and they start, you know, petting them, like, you know, just really petting them or hugging them. And this startles them. And so startle aggression is common. So it's like suddenly they wake up and they're not fully conscious even, and they may go and bite just as kind of a reactive response. So don't bother them when they're sleeping. The term is resources, but like their toys or their food, you know, these are objects and things that are, to a dog, what is mine is mine. It's not yours. I don't share very well. And so when, you may approach, if I'm eating out of my food dish or buy my food, and all of a sudden you come around and you touch me, I may perceive that, this dog being the dog, I'm talking like the dog now, as a threat. You may take my food, so I need to growl or possibly snap at you because I don't want you to have my food. So leave a dog alone when they're eating. Leave a dog alone with his toy. If you need to get the food or the toy away from the dog, call the dog away. Trade up, as we say. Get a much more yummy, appealing treat. Call the dog to come to you. You give them the treat, and as they're taking the treat away from that object, then you remove the object. Do not reach down in front of the dog and take the food away. Do not pet the dog when they're eating or when they're chewing on the rawhide, etc.
Okay. And if you're approaching a dog, if you're approaching a dog you don't know,
mm-hmm.
Maybe someone else's pet, maybe with their owner,
mm-hmm.
What are the basic steps to remember?
Okay. There's an acronym. It's on the AVMA video, which is great. And it's called WAIT, W-A-I-T. And what that stands for is watch. Does a dog look relaxed? So let's say I see you, you've got your pet Labrador, you know, you're walking down the street and I'm like, oh, hi, Jim. And I come walking up to you. Now to the dog, I'm approaching the dog. But before I come right up to you or reach out, I want to do nothing with that dog. I want to wait and see how relaxed this dog looks. And then A, ask if I want to pet your dog. I need to ask you before I do, because this may be a good day or maybe it's a bad day. Like I said about, you know, say getting shots or maybe your dog had an ear infection. It's like, man, today's not a good day to try to pet him because he's kind of ouchy. Just say hi from where you are. You know, that's the best thing. So ask, that's A. I is invite. I'm going to stand there with my hand closed and maybe say, hi, chummy, and the dog. And I want the dog to come to me. If the dog kind of comes to me or approaches me or extends his head to me, that dog is saying, I want to come to you. Okay, so rather than me getting into the dog space, I'm waiting to see for the dog to come into my space. And then the touch. The touch for universally for all dogs, known or not, is generally from behind the head on the shoulders over the back. Do not reach over the head. Now, I know a lot of dogs may like rubbing behind the ears and head. When they know you very well and they trust you very well, that can be very appealing. But if they really don't, reaching over that head is around the eyes and the ears. It can be sensitive. It also can be kind of threatening to them, just like if I were to reach over your head right now. So just, you know, we're talking about safety here. First place, over the shoulders, down to about the middle of the back. And two or three times, and then I say stop, let the dog ask again. And that's the best way to greet.
Okay. We have an email here from someone with a dog bite question. And she writes, my boyfriend was bitten by a dog as a young child. He ended up with more than 100 stitches in his lower lip at age 5. He was bitten again when he was in high school and needed several stitches in his forearm. I love dogs, and I really want to get a big dog that I could run with, maybe a lab or a husky. But he is really uneasy about dogs of that size. And so the question to you, Dr. Sally Foote, is do you have any tips on how to help the boyfriend get over this fear, or is it best for our writer to settle for a smaller dog and compromise?
I really appreciate this question coming in because it gives us an opportunity to actually talk a little bit about the bite victim. This boyfriend is, and it's natural and this is normal, to be, he is actually somewhat afraid. He has a memory of probably a big dog was a dog that bit him. And even if it wasn't, still, he doesn't, just like you, Jim, he doesn't know, what did I do when I was five that ended up with this? I mean, that's pretty bad, 100 stitches to the face. Okay, so this is a traumatic experience for your boyfriend that, you know, has it in his memory and that. And so if he knows, and this is true, a bigger dog has a bigger bite. So if there just might be, who knows, you know, that slip up, like we said, a bite's going to occur. He knows that I'm going to have a bigger possible injury with the bigger dog, which also may be a part of why he's much more wary of the large breed dog. And, you know, breeds of dogs do not guarantee temperament. So, you know, I would say this. There is, there are a couple of websites. And on the AVMA website, I do believe there is some links for people who've been bitten by dogs to help with some relaxation exercises they can do around dogs and to how to pay attention to the body language of the dog that says, hi, I'm relaxed, I'm friendly, I'm not threatened by you, therefore I'm not likely to bite, as well as the dogs who are nervous to avoid possibly getting bitten. So going back to your question is, you want a running buddy and you love dogs. I would tend to suggest a smaller breed dog because you're negotiating this within your relationship. The two of you, both you and your boyfriend, need to be, you know, happy with this decision. A smaller breed dog that's kind of high energy can run along with you very well, just as much as a larger breed dog, and if in a way, almost maybe a little bit better when we consider some of the hip dysplasia problems we get with the larger breed dogs. Perhaps like a mixed breed dog that might be, you know, around 40 pounds in weight, 30 pounds in weight. You can go to some of the shelters where, especially here in Champaign at the Humane Society, they have done a very good kind of behavior temperament screening, and also have some volunteers that actually take some of these adoptable dogs, say, running, to know that they are a good, you know, dog for running. And you and your boyfriend may not only visit, but perhaps even, you know, go a few times and be perhaps a, you know, volunteer that takes the dog out and see how the two of you relate and kind of try it out. But the two things I would recommend is sit down and have a heart-to-heart with your boyfriend, go to the AVMA sources for some of the bite victims, you know, because this is no fun for him feeling afraid. And I would recommend for a smaller breed dog. I think that's going to be the best for both of you.
Okay. No huge dogs at this point anyway.
No, maybe down the road, but, you know, a bigger the dog, the bigger the bite. Any dog can bite.
Let me get to the websites we've been throwing out. AVMA.org is the American Veterinary Medicine Organization, and they sponsor National Dog of Bite Prevention Week. So mm-hmm. if you go to AVMA.org, you'll certainly find some materials about dog bite prevention. But also the website for your clinic in Tuscola, OKAW Vet Clinic. That's OKAW Vet Clinic. com. There's some materials over there on this dog bite question. We are talking about pet care, not just dog bites, but any questions that you have about pet care with Dr. Sally Foote of the OKAW Vet Clinic in Tuscola. You can give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 for a toll-free connection. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. When you're dealing with children and dog bites, and really, because you can't give them a really complex explanation of mm-hmm. what to do, are there really some just some good basic things that they should know?
Yes. First of all, let's kind of talk about the different ages of children. Talk to expectant parents in the baby safety talk. When we have an infant, and I mean a child from birth to, you know, easily a year, when they're getting up to the walking age, never, never leave a dog alone with a child at all. I mean, I say that for kids up to six, but especially do not leave the child laying on the floor in a blanket. You know, don't leave them laying on a bed, you know, by themselves, because when that child is rolling and squealing around, they look like a dead animal and they want to, you know, pounce on them, and that can happen. The second thing is for children then kind of going through that toddler age all the way up to the school age. Again, parent, an adult needs to be present all the time to supervise dog-child interaction. But what you do is we need to tell our kids, do not get in the face of a dog. Don't, you know, go right up to the face to greet them and that. And so with that toddler, if they start getting close to the dog, you, the parent, are going to need to take little Johnny by the hand and actually guide them away and say, play over here. And then there's some ways you can have some fun games with the dog, say, out in the yard with the child, say, throwing the ball for the dog. We don't want children running and the dog chasing the dog. Child, excuse me, because that's where the dog may jump up and grab their shirt tail and possibly nip and bite them. So staying out of the face of a dog, staying away when they're eating and that, and not running and getting into a lot of these chase the child games.
Okay. Let's go to a caller. Line one, we're talking with Sheila in Effingham. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I have a question about my two-year-old golden retriever. When I take her for a walk, I really like to walk, and I walk at a fairly brisk pace. I don't run at all. But if I go a mile, she's okay. But if I go more than a couple miles, she's not. She pulls back, and you know, I have to kind of keep kind of tugging at her to keep up with me, and her tongue starts to hang out, and she pants. And I know she's heavily coated, and I take, you know, ice with me, or, you know, some place where I can stop and give her water. But I was just kind of worried as to whether I should be concerned about, like, a heart condition or some other condition that might be contributing, or am I over-worrying?
Well, let me just ask you a few more questions, if you don't mind. Has this just started up recently? In other words, did you
she's always been that way. She's from a puppy.
Oh, from a puppyhood. Okay. If she's panting and if she, you know, is obviously tired after, say, 3 miles or 4 miles, then I would definitely, yes, make sure that you are up to date on all her heartworm testing and, you know, heartworm prevention. Have your veterinarian maybe take a chest x-ray. We do see heart disease in dogs, especially in the purebred dogs. Now, I don't know that's definitely the problem, but first of all, we want to screen for any possible, you know, physical problems. But if consistently throughout the year you've seen this, I would definitely take her to your vet to screen for, you know, her endurance is not really that great, where for a larger breed dog that tends to be, you know, they tend to have more endurance than this.
Right.
The second thing could be if perhaps you only really hit this longer mileage maybe once or twice a week, like you go 1 or 2 miles most of the working week, but come Saturday, Sunday, perhaps if you go 5 or 6 miles on that day, she needs more conditioning. You know, it's like too much of a jolt to her system to double or triple up the mileage for her. So it may do better to try to either up the mileage or give her like 2 shorter walks, you know what I mean, like two mile walks through the week so that she has that endurance for the 4 mile walk during the week. Now, when, you know, because panting and if she's dragging back and that is she's tired. And secondly, if you start to get into the tug of war, now you're making it very stressful and anxiety producing for her, where she may be having a blend of that. So when you're on the walk, you know, panting and like, I've got to stop, I want to stop and sniff, you know, just like a person who's tired. Sometimes with these dogs, if you just sort of stop and wait 5 minutes, then she's up and she's like, okay, I can go now. But if you're like, no, she's not really picking up the speed, you'd be better off to head back home, you know, praise and reward her, because she's telling you, I'm just kind of done and you're ready to keep going and I'm not, you know, say, okay, here's your point of conditioning. We're going to go back home. Praise her as she walks. You know, you got to keep it positive for her so she's not getting anxious about going out walking. Then you go ahead and do a little bit of extra mileage and then maybe plan out a better workout session. Has she ever been like a dog come charging at her when she was on leash with you at this kind of your route when you get out to like 3 and 4? You know, some kind of an incident that might have been scary or startling or anything?
No, she just doesn't like, you know, trucks or trailers on.
Okay, that's noise.
Yeah.
That's a lot of noise. So you need to, when on a regular walk, you need to, when you're out there, and this is just general information. If she's really getting really upset, then call me and we need to do a consult. But very general, even on your little 1 mile walk, whenever the truck first starts approaching, and watch her body language, you know, if her tail starts going down, if her ear starts going back, if she's pulling back and kind of winding around you, stop. and you put her in a sit. Say, look at me. Good girl. Lots of praise. She needs lots of praise for not worrying about this truck going by. And maybe even have a couple little treats that you've broken up into the size of a half a Cheerio. Treats need to be tiny because it's just this little tidbit. And then you would say, good girl, because then she associates that with the noise going by. Some dogs do a lot better if you do have, say, construction or, you know, a lot of noise in some areas. Using like the Adaptyl product is a calming pheromone spray that can help some of these dogs when it's walk time, because then she can be more calm and she then she can take the reward and associate good on the walk.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Sheila. And we're talking about pet care today on Focus with Dr. Sally Foote. Here's a question coming in. In January, our family adopted a dog from the American Brittany Rescue Organization. He is a wonderful pet, great with our kids as far as temperament goes, but he has no interest in playing with toys. We've tried a variety from rope bones to soft toys to various balls. The rescue folks had told us they believe he's about 3.5 years old. They think he was trained to hunt. Would that have taken the play out of him? He's got a submissive personality compared to other Brittanys, and he's the biggest lap dog I've ever seen, always wanting to be loved on. He's an indoor dog with plenty of room, but he also loves spending lots of time outside chasing birds and rabbits. Our boys would love to be able to play fetch and tug of war with our furry companion. He will run and chase with us if we can get him going, but that's about all the playing he will do. Any advice?
Okay, this is a very a really interesting kind of case question, and I'm sorry. Okay, so what we can say, what we know about your Brittany is this. First of all, he loves chasing, but he likes chasing the actual bird. He likes chasing the actual wildlife. And if you think about it, first of all, as you said, the rescue said they think or they know that he was raised primarily, you know, for hunting. So for this Brittany, it's very possible. The only time he got out of, say, a kennel or a pen area was to go out and go hunting. He never had any play. Now, it doesn't mean that he cannot kind of learn how to play, you know, or develop play. But you just got this dog, I guess, in this past January. So it's only been 4 months for him to adjust to everything else about living in your home. And as you said, a submissive personality actually probably means he's still a little nervous and unsure of everything that goes on in your home. So first thing is make sure you have a lot of regular routines. Dogs love routines, meaning that you're feeding him at the same time every day. You remove the food after 20 minutes so he sees that, you know, you're in control of the food. And that's not just about obedience, but it helps him to know that you're a reliable leader. And this helps to reduce a lot of anxiety for the dog in general about the home. Outside in the yard, think about it. A bird, you know, whatever, a squirrel, is very unpredictable about how it runs around and moves, which is really fun for this dog. So any kind of ways to think about a toy with your children that can be more kind of like how a squirrel or a bird will run around will probably be more fun for this dog. And I have even seen there are some toys that have like a furry tail on them that you can throw. That may tempt the dog to want to then go and chase on that. Have your children take this dog out on a walk. Walks are very settling for the dog. It's a way for this dog to get out and sniff, you know, wildlife and things. Even if it's just for 5 minutes, if he doesn't know to heel well, it's less frustrating. But that's a fun thing for the dog to associate with your children, which will generally get him to more relax that you can then find ways, you know, of playing with them.
I'm reminded of a dog, not my dog. It was a landlord's dog back in the 1990s at the building I lived in. Very friendly, affectionate dog, but really had no concept as far as fetching after things.
Right.
You would throw a ball and the dog would sort of look at you like, what did you do that for?
Yeah, and you know, you think about it, the fetch is retrieving. And retrieving is a trait, and it's been really selected for and refined in our retrievers, like Labradors and Golden Retrievers. Now, the Brittany Spaniel, that is more of a flushing kind of a dog, not for retrieving. The Brittany is not really so much, they're supposed to like see the bird, you know, sniff it out and then get it to fly up in the air so the hunter kills it, but not so much about necessarily focused on bringing it back, you know, to the hunter, from what I understand of and that. So anyway, Brittany's maybe more what we call birdie, looking for the things that's going to suddenly fly up and they can run around after it and that. And so fetch may not be the game for this dog. It may be more of something a little bit like, quite honestly, a remote control car. that the kids could zip around in an unusual way, that they put like a little, you know, like a furry cat toy on it because it looks like the squirrel. I'm serious here, folks. Or, you know, taping a feather on as a way to get the dog to play, you know, just to get the dog kind of enticed into play. And I don't know if you might have some firm ground in the backyard, but, you know, that's the kind of idea. You're going to have to be a little creative to help this little dog out, but, you know, or throwing a Frisbee up in the air, you know, because it's more like a bird flying up.
Well, let's go to another caller on line four. This is Bob in Terre Haute. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hello. A couple of weeks ago, I saw a dog rolling around in the residue left from a 2-week-old roadkill. And then I'd never seen that before, and then I saw it again a couple of weeks later, and I've asked some people about that, and they say that's not uncommon, but I'd never seen it, and why are they doing that?
Oh, thank you. Wow. Okay. Just about all dogs and even cats really love dead things. And Jim and I were just talking a little bit about this before the program started. Okay. So, you know, exactly why some of the sort of theories about this is out in kind of the wild, a dog may want to cover themselves with the scent of something else. And as a way of deterring, say, another predator or whatever. But actually, I think a lot of times it's just a way of the dog kind of finding out what this whole thing is and, you know, how should I say, sort of experiencing it. This is very common. You commonly will see a lot of dogs go to something that's dead and immediately sort of flop down and roll across the back and shoulders on it. It'll drive pet owners crazy because now they're rolling in this disgusting stuff, but that is normal dog behavior. And, you know, sometimes they might do that before they actually say were to have consumed this dead kill, or maybe they don't consume it, but still. I can't tell you exactly why they do that, and I apologize, but this is very common dog behavior and, you know, not at all unusual.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Bob. Let's go ahead and take a short break. We have an email we'll get to from Aaron after we come back with more pet care advice from Dr. Sally Foote. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We are back on Focus with veterinarian and cat and dog behavior specialist Dr. Sally Foote. She has a clinic, the Okaw Vet Clinic in Tuscola. Their website is okawvetclinic.com. And Sally's ready to answer your questions about pet care when you call 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can send them to us also on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. You know, on what our caller Bob from Terre Haute said just a moment ago about dogs who like to roll around in stuff, I guess that sounds, apparently it's a natural trait. Mm-hmm. Is it really hard to train a dog not to do unless you really just are watching them closely?
Yes, it would be very difficult to train them not to do that. So what would be the situations where they could, you know, be rolling in something dead? If your dog is, you know, off-leash roaming, say a rural dog that's just off-leash roaming around, it's going to happen, you know. And I think most people who have a rural dog kind of know that and accept that and are ready to wash, you know, give their dog a bath or beware of some of the upset stomach if they ate, you know, that roadkill. Now, if you're walking your dog on leash and you see your dog, of course, may see like the squirrel or, you know, animal that's been hit by a car in the middle of the street there, they're going to want to pull you over right there to it. So what would you do? When they see that is they want to start to pull, you stop walking. Okay, if you just plant your feet, the dog can't get to it. That's step one of, I'm not going to let you get to that. Number two is, you know, get your dog's attention, praise them, and then keep walking past that roadkill, constantly praising them or giving them even a reward, because now what you're doing is you're training and rewarding the dog for making the choice to not go to the roadkill, and you have the control of the leash. But without the control of the leash, boy, 9 times out of 10, they're going to be over on that roadkill.
and the problem is you cannot make a logical argument to the dog about why they should not.
Absolutely.
Do it.
That's correct. Yeah. We are different than dogs.
Okay. Let's go over to line four and Karen in Charleston. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wondered if the doctor could address the issue of pet owners letting their dogs ride in the back of pickup trucks. I witnessed a dog who jumped out of the back of a pickup truck, and that image has haunted me. And I see a lot of people doing it, and I just wondered about your opinion on that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Karen, thank you. This is a really, it's a good thing to bring up. Let me put it that way. I do not like dogs riding loose in the back of pickup trucks. Some states even have laws that make that illegal. So what to do? You know, it's all about educating and, you saw a dog jump out of the back of a pickup truck. And if that, you know, truck was moving, that dog may have been injured. Or if the dog was not injured, he was very close to getting, you know, breaking a leg or getting hurt badly jumping out. And so I think that you should tell people, people should speak up who, you know, have seen that and say to them, you know, you may not see the problem in this, but I saw a dog jump out and almost get strangled. I've seen that. Jumping out where their leash gets caught if they're wearing one, or a choke chain type collar, or even the regular collar, or I saw the dog leap out and almost get hit by another car coming, et cetera. And, you know, these things can happen, and I'd hate for that to happen to your pet. Please have them ride up in the cab. That's safer for them. Or at the very least, have a kennel in the back for the dog to ride in. They do make these kind of, I don't know, like a track thing that the leash can, you know, can go down in the bed of the truck, and then this leash setup will hook into that. Frankly, I prefer a crate than the dog loose in the back, or even that kind of tie down sort of setup for the dog. Secondly, the thing we really have to be aware about too with being in the back of a pickup truck as summer comes on is these dogs will overheat. It's horrible. I will not go into it. We had a horrible, horrible case of an overheating that came in off the road on 57 to my office last summer. I will not go into details. The poor dog died, and that's where that dog was, in the back of the pickup, and they were not aware of how this dog was quickly overheating in that metal area. It's just like this well. So the second thing is, we're approaching summer. That's a really compelling reason for, don't have them in the back of the pickup loose, have them in the cab. If you have to have them in the back of the pickup, very minimal time, very minimal time.
And that brings up the question of heat in the summertime and your pet, whether it's a dog or another animal, maybe some good rules of thumb to make do your best to keep your animal from overheating.
Right.
Especially maybe outdoor animals.
Right. Well, the first thing is, okay, hopefully everybody knows, never, never, never leave a dog or a cat closed up in a car. Even if the window's down halfway or whatever, they will get hot quickly. And we have, like, on our website, and many of the other veterinary clinics have done this, is posting on websites and our Facebook pages, the little chart. You know, it's 70 degrees outside in 1 minute in a car. It's going to be 100 degrees, like, in a few minutes, and 120 in another few minutes. So even if you think you're just running into the store for a minute, take your pet with you or drop your pet off at home and go do your errands without your pet. Okay, so secondly then, what else? Water just in the backyard isn't enough for your pet. And a shade tree is good, but these animals mostly lose their heat through contact on a cool surface. Again, why the pickup truck's bad, because it's hot in that bed. So if they're outside in the backyard, you need to be sure that they can be underneath a shade tree where they can actually really lay on the grass. Get them a haircut. How do we tell overheating in the pet? When they first start panting and don't want to accept water, they keep getting up and moving around because they're trying to find a place that's cool. That means get them out of the heat and into, like, a basement where it's cool, or into air conditioning.
We have a caller standing by. I do want to get to an email that's come in from Aaron. We recently adopted a 2-year-old female cat to keep our 9-year-old male cat company. It's been a few months and they are still not getting along. Our old cat now spends all of his time in our bed and cannot leave the bed even to use the litter box without the new cat frightening him. Do you have any tips for how we might lessen the new cat's aggression towards our old cat? She is completely sweet with humans. We really hope we can find a way to make this work.
Okay, thank you. Cats need an introductory period. And what we mean by that is that I have this on my OCAW Vet Clinic website. If you want to go there and see under pet articles, cat behavior, it's how to introduce two cats. But basically it's this. First of all, we need to actually have your older kitty, the new kitty rather, set up in like a room with the door closed, food and litter box, etc. And your older kitty has the roam of the house, but we're going to feed the two cats on either side of the door such that they get to the point where they're able to eat. And they know, because they know each other's there, with the door as a barrier. Then we change to like more of a screen, like a baby gate. And then when the two cats are eating comfortably with the screen in between, then we take the screen away. And we can then still supervise and maybe put up the new kitty for a little time at night so old kitty has some break time. Secondly, here's a rule of thumb with cats. Whenever you add a cat, you have to add 3 additional perches that are for this new cat to be able to sleep and lay on in your home that the cat likes, and your present older cat needs to still have his perches in places he likes to go readily available for him. So for these 2 cats, we're now talking about 6 obvious places that they can hop up, look out the window, and go that are separate, because a lot of times cats are kind of fighting for this space and we don't really realize it, and their own separate litter boxes. And when I say separate, they don't see each other. We also do not want to feed them out of the same dishes either. We want them to have food dishes that are at least 6 feet away and the cats don't see each other. Lastly, play. That you will, or you're some other family member, will have active 10 minutes a day playtime with new kitty separate from old kitty, and then old kitty gets old kitty friendly playtime separate as well. And then you can have time together for the 2 of them. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. There may be more, but hope that helps.
Okay. It sounds like a gradual process.
Yes, it is. Cats need more time.
Let's go to line 1, and this is David in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hello. I've heard that it's not good for particularly young border collies to play with frisbees, that they can injure their backs.
Okay. Thank you. Border collies are a highly active dog, and they really, really love to play, play and fetch ball, you know, because this is kind of going on that herding instinct of chasing things around and down. You know, it's how you play frisbee with them. That's a very, very broad generalization, you know, applied to just the border collie. There's nothing that much in the border collie as a general breed that makes their back worse than any other breed. Now, you have some border collies that are so frisbee crazy, and then, of course, people that are hurling the frisbee up, you know, 15 feet in the air, and the dog's jumping up, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet and crashing down and doing this repeatedly. Yeah, doing this repeatedly. That's too much. Okay, so... But so if we're playing Frisbee right, Frisbee is a wonderful game to play with your border collie. And so, you know, sailing it where it maybe is whatever, like my shoulder height, you know, and as it comes down, the border collie might jump up 1 foot or two and bring it back to me, or I may release a second one. That's fine play for them, provided we don't have any other pre-existing injury, you know, like a border collie that got hit by a car, or a border collie that's 12 or 14 years old, you know, that might have it. So... I would disagree with that statement with some caveats, if that helps you out.
I think so, yes.
Do you have a border collie?
I've had them in the past, and thinking about another. Mm-hmm. They're wonderful dogs as long as you're smarter than they are.
Yes, and they have outlet for active play.
Yes, I had one that her favorite game was fence jumping.
Right.
She'd never clear a fence by more than a quarter inch.
Uh-huh.
And then she'd do a 180 and land facing the fence and wait for you to raise your hand to jump back.
Okay.
And of course, she'd keep this up until your arm fell off.
It was a game. She made
it was a game.
Yeah, fence jumping a game.
But they're wonderful dogs, but mm-hmm. they are high maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. The thing about dogs and their backs, is that a rule of thumb for other dogs? Not trying to entice them to jump too high?
Yes, that would be so. I mean, the dogs really get very, you know, kind of worked up, you know what I mean, really hyped up and like jumping for that ball or jumping for that frisbee. And because going up, they can be very agile and they're looking right at that frisbee or right at that ball. They may twist their back and body around because they're focused on, you know, getting that ball. They don't think about what the crash landing is going to be like, you know, or what it might be like on them. And so we can see, you know, if I throw it up, you know, 6, 7 feet high in the air, my dog's going to do this funny twist and may land bad, which could bust out her cruciate ligament, you know, or hurt her back, whatever. So now I should throw it in a way that's going to have an easier way for her to catch it and land and still get her aerobic outlet out.
Okay. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote to answer your questions about pet care. Call us at 333-9455. Are toll-free 1-800-222-9455. or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We've been talking earlier. This is National Dog Bite Prevention Week. And if you go to Dr. Sally Foote's website, okavetclinic.com, or if you go to the avma.org website, actually, you can go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. And the page for today's program, you'll find links to some advice, including a video embedded on our website about preventing dog bites. One thing I'm wondering about, when dog bites happen, what as far as, you know, what should we be looking at to, as far as gauging their severity and what sort of first aid is needed?
Well, any time that there is any kind of puncture, you know, to the skin, certainly go to the doctor, get it cleaned out. Dog mouths carry bacteria just like our mouth carries bacteria. So whenever there is any obvious, you know, puncture, deep bruising, even if you don't see a puncture, you know, you should get it checked out by the doctor. Now, that step will generate a bite report. It's required by law that the doctor hospital facility report to the county that this dog has bitten. That's a part of rabies control. Even if your dog doesn't have rabies, it's the law. So, you know, there will be a process then. The dog will be under quarantine and that. So if the dog, though, has not actually made contact, like they grabbed your shirt sleeve, they just missed, you know, what we call a snap in the air, that is still considered a bite. There's a grading system or levels of bites from 1 to 5, 1 being like I just snapped, but I didn't actually grab you. I'm ready to bite you. You know, I'm giving the warning. Either I missed or I kind of just purposely missed or really, really warn you, all the way up to where the dog is, you know, grabbing, biting, you know, multiple deep and pulling and tearing flesh, et cetera, with really intent to kill. And that's a level 5. So when we're at the snapping phase, before there's any actual grab of the skin, or you just maybe grabbed your coat sleeve, do not ignore that. That counts as a bite. We've got, you know, aggression here. There's something really going bad for this dog. This dog feels threatened to the point that they're going to use all their tools to tell you, stop, stop, what's going on here. Pay attention to the scene. What's happening? Let's not repeat this. Let's start with avoidance, you know, in that. But for medical attention, most certainly too with children and the seniors and the elderly, do not wait to get, you know, things checked out because oftentimes antibiotic care is needed.
I'm wondering also, if you have a dog that seems prone to biting, are trying to bite, is there any way that you can change its behavior?
Yes, you can. This is all about aggression is managed. First of all, it's not cured. Just like me and you, Jim, we can be aggressive. You can get really angry, right? You could really, if you felt very threatened, you know, you could really haul off and either try to hit or use a weapon, etc. But as long as those bad things aren't happening around you, you are not threatened such that you use, you know, those tools or choose to go that way. And that's what aggression management is about. Now, depending on how severe the aggression is, the genetics of the dog, the size of the dog, and whether or not we can identify the triggers and avoid them and manage them, that's all the parts that have to be answered to say for this dog, you know, in these situations that we now know they have aggression. And there's about 15 major classifications of canine aggression. There's not just one type, and sometimes dogs may have 3 or 4 types. Then this is where the behavior analysis comes in, and it's really best, especially in aggression, done by a veterinarian, because pain aggression is very common. Very common that we have some level of body chronic pain that is getting in there and making this aggression worse, like bad teeth, chronic skin, bad ears, or arthritis. And dogs are not going to limp and cry in pain when they're in pain until they're totally up at the top of pain. So by a veterinarian, and then from that evaluation can tell you what's the prognosis, you know, for being able to manage and cure, manage this, and what will that require. And then from that, we discuss with the family, is this something, you know, you're going to want to do, just like with a medical diagnosis. You know, if I diagnosed diabetes in a pet, I'm going to have to talk about, you know, medication, changing diet, you know, scheduling things like insulin shots, and can this family do this? And so that's what it involves.
Okay, so it's not something you can do with just, say, a few pointers. It's something you really have to look at the individual dog and bring in a professional, it sounds like.
Yes, and if at least you know there's certain settings where this dog will aggress, set up a happy place for the dog completely separate from it.
One thing I was thinking of, fleas and ticks, warm weather. Fleas and ticks mm-hmm. are coming out there in a way that they weren't, I guess, in December.
Right.
What is just some good things to do every year as the weather comes in?
Right now, that there are a lot of choices in flea and tick products. We have ticks out, and they're heavy. They're already out there, pretty strong and very good. Fleas are starting to be on the uptick. Fleas really like kind of the cooler, more humid weather and that. So all of our canine heartworm products and the feline heartworm product revolution not only protect from heartworm, but a lot of them also now have agents in there to also protect from fleas and or ticks. So what works for a lot of my clients is to choose the products that are a combination of that, and then you're getting very broad spectrum control of heartworm, intestinal worms, as well as the fleas. If we have them on, say, a heartworm product that doesn't control that, the best and safest flea and tick protection products for dogs and cats are the ones sold by Advantage or Frontline. And really double check with your veterinarian. A lot of the over-the-counter products that may say they're okay for cats are still highly toxic to cats. And so before you put on some of the Hearts or Sargent's products, while they may say they're okay for cats, oftentimes cats may get sick by those. So please consult with your veterinarian before you apply that on your cat. But right now, get them on the monthly products. Keep them on it. We need a hard snow on the ground before fleas are dead. So they need to be on it now all the way through fall and into early winter.
Here's a question emailed in from Amy. It reminds me of the two cats who have trouble getting along from our previous writer. We will be blending two households mm-hmm. and moving into a new house simultaneously.
Oh, boy.
My partner has a female cat, and I have a dog and a female cat. Any suggestions to how to introduce the three of them to each other as well as a new home? I am pretty nervous about how this will go.
Okay, thank you. Well, congratulations that you're blending this household. I think this is wonderful. And yes, it can work out, but you're going to need to have a plan and you're going to need to give it a little time. First things for cats is this. Now with this move, cats need to rub up on everything around your house as a way of saying, this is mine and I love this space. So we are doing a lot's going on for these cats. First thing I would suggest is each cat gets its own individual room set up as its own little kitty house for the first couple days, because they need to be able to rub up on that and, you know, get used to the smells of the house as individual cats before bringing them together as, you know, buddy cats. And then whichever cat is kind of the more outgoing and relaxed type of cat by their temperament, after maybe 5 days in their own environment, you know, and they're feeling pretty good, then let the more outgoing kind of cat out to check out more of the house, keeping the other cat behind the door and doing that feeding by the door like I described earlier. Please go to my website and see the How to Introduce Two Kitty Siblings. For the dog, make sure the dog has his feeding area, you know, separate from the cat's. The cat's food is not where the dog can get into it. You get your dog on plenty of regular exercise so he's not chasing the cats. Even if he didn't chase the cat he lives with, he might want to chase this new cat. Then in your new home, you've got to set up at least 6 separate perching areas for these two cats. Remember what I said? 3 perching areas per cat. You've got 2 cats, that means 6. And especially high places like up on top of, say, the dresser, about that height, waist height, and higher for the cats to hop up and get away from the dog. Cats, sometimes the reason why they don't like the dogs or get upset with the dogs is because they are kind of trapped by the dog. They don't have anywhere to hop up and get away. And then lastly, Feel Away is a great pheromone product. It comes as a diffuser you can plug in the wall or spray you can use around the house. I would suggest a spray you can use around this new home because it will help these cats to feel like it's their home and it can help them to be more calm.
Okay. Final question coming in. Came in from our technical director, who is a dog owner, and I guess he has practical experience. Allergies, which can hit a lot of animals pretty hard just about now.
Yeah, yes. We are starting to see our, you know, skin problems in dogs and sometimes in cats, and allergies is one of them.
And they can really suffer from this stuff.
Oh, yes, they can. They can. Allergies can be related to food. They can be related to what they're inhaling, pollens and such, or what they're getting into contact with, you know. And sometimes even the pollens and things in the air will settle on their skin. And so they can be both a contact and inhaled allergy. So a couple of things, you know, first of all, if your pet's having any rashes or sores on their skin, go to the vet, get them examined, have the skin scrapings done or whatever other tests. Allergies can be checked, like specific allergies can be checked for through blood tests. We do have allergen shots for dogs. So, and then follow what your veterinarian recommends. Oftentimes they're going to recommend maybe a low allergy diet because allergies are additive. You know, they may have food allergy and inhalant allergy. And if we can at least eliminate and control what we can say by food, it can help the inhalant one be better. Antihistamines are used. Which antihistamine? Well, we have a choice of a number. And so it's kind of a little bit of hit or miss or which one do we think is going to work best with this pet. Bathing. Bathing is very important. Regular weekly bathing in the appropriate pet shampoo that is recommended by your veterinarian. There are shampoos that are soap-free, so they're not irritating. Some that even have an antihistamine in the shampoo as a part of controlling, you know, that with allergy. And sometimes there can be underlying medical problems like hypothyroidism that also is triggering more of an allergic response. So if we've had real chronicness with this allergy and it's like, or it's getting worse, we had it well managed 2 years ago and now it's worse this year, it may be time for getting some blood work done and screening, you know, the internal health.
Okay, so something to watch out for, especially as things start to grow and pollinate and blow around. Just about out of time on Focus Today. I want to thank veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote for joining us on Focus Today. And your website is okavetclinic.com. And you'll find a link to that as well as links to some useful dog bite prevention information on our website for today's show at will.illinois.edu/focus. Sally, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about Dog Bite Prevention Week and everything else.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Monday on Focus for Memorial Day, an encore broadcast of a program from January about changes in the U.S. military. What does the official sanctioning of combat roles for women mean for the armed forces? And what changes do veterans have to adjust to when they make the transition from military to civilian life? We'll find out more on Monday's encore edition of Focus. Focus Today is produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows.